And hello out there, and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM, broadcasting from the UC Irvine campus and streaming live at KUCI.org. Today's Wednesday, November 7th, 2018. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, recovering from an election night with former co-host Nicole Nelson and some other friends in Newport Beach. Some interesting changes. Let's see what happens. We're not going to go into politics today, though, not directly. We're going to talk about writing. And my guests today are novelists Hallie Efron and Lisa Brockman. First up is Hallie Efron. She's the New York Times bestselling author of Never Tell a Lie, Come and Find Me, There Was an Old Woman, and Night, Night, Sleep Tight. For 12 years, she was the crime fiction reviewer for the Boston Globe. She's the daughter of Hollywood screenwriters, grew up in Beverly Hills, lives near Boston, and she's here today primarily to talk about her newest novel, You'll Never Know, Dear, published by Morrow. Hi, Hallie.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
Barbara, I'm so happy to be here.
I'm so glad to have you. Let's at least begin talking about your current novel, You'll Never Know, Dear. Tell us about that. How's that for a nice, big, broad question?
It's a detour for me. You know, most of my books, I write about women, usually families with secrets. My books are called creepy, but not icky. And I like to kind of walk that line in suspense where you want to know what's going on here, books more than mysteries. And Careful What You Wish For is set somewhere I've never set a book before. It's in the South, where I had very little experience. I had been to Florida, which isn't really the South, and I'd been to D.C., which isn't really the South. So I had to make some special trips to South Carolina to get my head wrapped around just how people talk, how they treat each other, how they walk on the street, all the really basic things you take for granted. And the other unusual thing about that book was that the idea came from someone else. You know, as a writer, there people come up to you all the time. They say, oh, I have a great idea for a book for you to write. And you always say, oh, well, good, you write it. I don't want your idea. But in this case, a friend of mine was telling me about her mother, who was elderly, and she'd had to move her out of this big home in, I think it was Fayetteville, North Carolina. And as she was emptying out the house, she emptied out all of her mother's doll-making supplies. Her mother made porcelain dolls. So there were molds and just lots and lots of dolls. And every time she reached under a bed, she would pull out boxes and boxes of doll parts. Doll parts. So heads, eyeballs, wigs. I just thought, wow, that is really creepy. And she must have thought the same thing, too, because she said to me, now that would be a great idea for one of your books. And I think it is. So the dolls, the book is about a doll maker. It's about a woman who makes porcelain dolls, and she made the first two she ever made for her kids. Mm. And when the littlest was very little, she was kidnapped, taken away with the doll. And the book opens 40 years later with the doll coming back. So the question, it's a book about finding a child, not really about losing a child. But inspired completely by, you know, right out of left field for me. And that's as a writer, you have to do that. You have to listen up to when something strikes you and you say, ah, well, that's interesting.
Yeah, so take us from, you know, meeting this woman, thinking about, oh, interesting, dolls. How could I use that in a book? Taking that to the point where you come up with the story of a missing child.
I mean, well, when I started to look up, you know, the internet is my friend. When I started to look up doll making and porcelain doll making in particular, I came across people who make porcelain portrait dolls. So these are dolls that are not only very lifelike, they look like a real child. And dolls are inherently creepy, like clowns are inherently creepy, just something about masks, things that look human but aren't quite, mannequins, you know, all those things have a good creepy quotient. And I thought, wow, a portrait doll is like creepy squared. That is really creepy to look like. And they are very creepy looking if you see these dolls. They're amazing works of art, really, or folk art anyway. And but they also really kind of creep you out. And I thought, well, if someone had a porcelain portrait doll of themselves, it would be recognizable to someone else. So that's where I got the idea of the missing child and the doll that goes missing with her. And then the doll comes back and they know it's her doll, because you wouldn't really know 40 years later that a doll was a child. So then I knew that the dolls had to be important to the book, and I had to in some way make those doll parts work in the books. Always have the kind of books I write always have a really big moment about 30 pages from the end or 20 pages from the end where everything collides, clashes, things that you didn't think were connected turn out to be, something is exactly the opposite of what you thought it was. And I knew that the doll parts were going to be pivotal to that moment. Now, I did not know how I was going to make that happen. I just went ahead and started writing. I had the setting, I had the doll comes back, and I wrote my way to the end, figuring it out as I went.
So, okay, so your books, you say, about 30 pages from the end, this thing happens, but you don't know it going in. You just know something is going to change.
Yeah. It's like, what did I say? Leap and the net will appear?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I feel that way about writing. I need a certain amount to get myself up on the ledge. But then I do leap and then figure it out.
And you trust the process.
I don't trust the process while it's happening. In retrospect, I do. During the process, I beat myself up and I say, what made me think I could do this? I'm out of my mind, and it always takes longer than I think it's going to. And it can be very discouraging. You have to just really keep at it. And I find, you know, one of the most fruitful times for what happens is you hit knotholes. You hit dead ends where you thought you were going to go this way, but then you get there and you realize that doesn't make any sense. No person would do what I'm about to make this character do, so I have to have her do something else. But what? And I often find if I just put it aside, that a very fertile time for me is when I'm falling asleep or when I'm waking up.
Mm-hmm.
And I always keep a pad of paper by the bed. And often, as I'm falling asleep, I make myself think about whatever problem I have at that moment in the book. And ideas will come to me. Some of them are ridiculous. I wrote them down anyway. Because sometimes a ridiculous idea leads to a good idea.
Mm.
So I write them down, and the same thing in the morning is just try to work out those cul-de-sacs.
Yeah. Well, you know, I wanted to ask you about your first chapter and in relation to prologues. We talk about prologues an awful lot on this show. We probably talk the topic into the ground. But in your first chapter, there's a bit of backstory that takes the reader up to speed with one of the main characters, Miss Sorrell. And I am curious about that because I think there are writers who would have made that a prologue, and you made it a first chapter. So I wanted to hear what you had to say about that and what you have to say about prologues.
Well, I like to start a story with the story, and often what people slap in as a prologue is backstory, in fact,
mm-hmm.
to the main story. In other words, it's the stuff that happened before, and that's the case here. And I just like to make it more organic to the opening of the book. I'm not one of those writers that believe you have to start off. And I write genre fiction. These are mystery novels, suspense, thrillers. That's where you'd find them on the shelf. And I know that that people will tell you have to start with a dead body or something very exciting happening. I just don't believe that. I believe that you can start slowly, that you can build, that you can put a character on the page, create who that character is, and create character, and then have things happen. That chapter, I think, ends with the woman comes back with the doll,
mm-hmm.
but we don't know that it's the doll yet. So, I mean, all of my books, if you read them, they all start with slowly. They build, and they build from character. Now, one exception, I do have a little prologue in one of my books. In Never Tell a Lie, and very briefly, Never Tell a Lie is the story of a very pregnant woman who has a yard sale right before she's about to give birth. And we all do that, nesting, getting rid of things. And a woman from her past who's also about to have a baby arrives at the yard sale. She looks around. She chats up the husband. She talks her way into the house. She wants to see the renovations they're doing. And she never comes out. So 3 days later, she's reported missing. So the opening scene is the yard sale, okay, and the woman goes in the house. And my daughter read that opening scene in the manuscript, and she said to me, Mom, she said, I love that opening scene, but I knew that she was going to disappear. And so it was much more, I don't know what word she used, suspenseful, gripping, interesting to me, because I knew that. And I thought, oh, geez, so how am I going to fix that? And what I did was I put a little news story, and it's really just three little paragraphs as the first chapter. It's like a prologue, but it's a news clipping. And it reports the yard sale, and the police are looking for the woman, and it gives the date. And then the next page opens 2 days earlier at the yard sale. And so the reader knows from having read the news article that she's going to disappear. And then, so that allowed me to create that suspense in the opening scene where it wouldn't have been there if you didn't know. So I think, bottom line, I think prologues are useful if they work for the book. I don't think they're a Band-Aid, and that's what I sometimes see them used as. Somebody has written an opening that people say, it's kind of flat, kind of went nowhere, didn't get interested till page 45, and they take whatever was on page 45 and they slap it in the opening as a prologue. Mm-hmm. And they say, oh, and then and the next chapter is, you know, a week earlier. Mm-hmm. And that just feels like a Band-Aid. It sticks out. It's all of a sudden the writer is looking at the reader from behind the curtain, and you never want, I would say, you never want them to see the strings. You know, you can create them, but you don't want it to be obvious that the writer is pulling punches. And that's what I think prologues can sometimes do. They can also sometimes work.
Hmm. Well, excuse me, how did you find your way to genre fiction?
How did I find my way to genre fiction? Well, I like to read it, which I think is a requirement for anybody writing anything. You need to like reading what you're writing, because you also then know what readers expect. And you know when you're breaking a rule, which you can break, but it's good to know. And I also didn't want to write, I have writing sisters. My sister Nora is very famous, Nora Ephron, who died a few years ago, and my sister Delia both are very amazing writers of romantic comedy. And I just knew that, first of all, I can't be funny for more than half a page at a time. I can't sustain it for a book. It's really hard. It's one of the hardest things to do ever. So I knew that was out for me, which was good because I don't really want to compete with them. I just want to do my own thing. And my younger sister at that time was writing kind of historical romances, which were wonderful. She's now moved on to middle grade fantasy. So I felt like that was my niche. That's what I like to read, and I understand it. I like a form that has a form. You know, I like to know where I'm going. I like to know that there's just an inherent structure in a mystery novel that and I wrote a book. I've got a book called Writing and Selling Your Mystery Novel that just came out in a revision a year and a half ago. And I'm an analytical kind of person. I was a teacher for many years. I like to think about the relationship of ideas. And mysteries are kind of puzzle creatures where you know where you're going, you try to make the pieces fit, you work back, you work forward. It's like a Rubik's Cube. And then what is revealed at the end should surprise you as well as the reader. I just like that. It's a satisfaction to it.
You know, I've heard so many literary writers say they turned to either writing suspense or mystery because in their literary novels, nothing much happened and they needed something to happen. And so,
exactly.
You know, here's the structure.
Yeah, it is. That is true. And very often I do a lot of teaching of writing at writing conferences, and I get to read a lot of aspiring writers' opening pages. And that's the most frequent problem is nothing happens. And yet I write books in which kind of nothing happens at the beginning. But there's nothing happens and nothing happens. Nothing happens in which you lose interest is not a good kind of nothing happens. Well, nothing happens and I want to see what's going to happen. That's a good kind.
Yeah, well, you know, I wanted to talk a little bit about suspense, and you talk about it quite a lot in your book, Writing and Selling Your Mystery Novel. But, you know, suspense is important to all fiction, to writing all fiction, maybe to all writing. And at the end of your first chapter, you know, you mentioned, and there's just this little thing that happens that, you know, where this woman brings the doll back and Miss Sorrell puts on her rubber gloves to examine the doll more closely. And so the reader wants to turn to the next chapter and see what happens. Why is she examining this doll? So when we talk about suspense or writing mystery or you know, getting something going on so that the reader wants to keep reading, it doesn't have to even be a big thing. It just has to be something, right?
Yes, it just has to be something. And the more organic it is, the more what will turn out to be central to the story is better. Often when you start reading a mystery novel, you know, you won't realize that the doll is that important. Except there's a doll on the cover of the book, so of course you assume it is. But if you, you know, and it's only as you read on that it creeps up on you, oh my God, there's the doll again. There's the doll again. You know, there's this kind of, the reader, I think in a really good suspense novel, the reader feels like they're doing the work.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the writer is laying out the crumbs, but the reader never wants to feel like they're spoon-fed. They want to feel like they are stepping into the gap between what the writer is saying and what is really happening and figuring things out. I mean, people love it when they can say to you, you know, oh, I figured out who did it, you know, before I got to the very end. Well, good. I mean, I hope, you know, that's a good thing. Otherwise, if it just comes out of left field and isn't believable, then people feel cheated. So, but suspense is that needing to know what's going to happen next. It's the charge you put in the gap between what's happening and what's going to happen. Hmm. And it's kind of like magnetic. It pulls the reader forward when it's working.
Yeah. We have a few minutes left. I've been with Hallie Efron. Her new novel is You'll Never Know, Dear. And also she has a book on writing called Writing and Selling Your Mystery Novel, which has been revised and expanded. But in the book on writing, you have a chapter on titles, and I wanted to talk about the title to You'll Never Know, Dear, because I noticed that your titles, they're all memorable. They're either from songs or nursery rhymes or, I don't know, they're very catchy. And I wondered then what part the title plays and when you have it. Do you have it going into a project or at some point does it reveal itself?
I almost never know it coming into the project. If you go onto my computer and you look at the files, the early versions of all my books, mm-hmm. they're called something totally different from what the book ended up being called. But I think I discovered my first book, which was called Never Tell a Lie. I wanted it to be called Baby Baby. It's about the two women who are pregnant, the two babies. And there's a moment where somebody sings that rock song, Baby, Baby, Baby. You remember that one?
Mm-hmm,
anyway,
mm-hmm.
I thought, great, Baby, Baby. And the publisher was not happy with that. They said, it's going to get put in the pregnancy and childbirth section or raising twins. Or it doesn't sound like a crime novel. So they gave me, you know, 1,000 different possible alternatives. And we settled on Never Tell a Lie. And ever since then, I like that feeling to it. So the next one was Come and Find Me. And the next one, Night, Night, Sleep Tight. They all have this kind of not one word, not punchy, not that, you know, thriller kind of title, Finding Amy, you know, mm-hmm. none of those kind of traditional titles of these kinds of books, but they have a kind of, as you say, almost like a fairy tale, a nursery rhyme, some kind of saying to it. The one I just finished is called Careful What You Wish For.
Mm-hmm.
So and they're all different. All my books are totally different from each other. They all have different characters and different settings, and you just never would confuse one with the other. And yet the titles kind of unify them under what I hope is my brand, you know, mm-hmm. that exactly that kind of title, which is kind of hard to... what I liked about You'll Never Know, Dear, is that I want the reader to think how much I love you.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Please Don't Take My Sunshine Away. So the meaning of the title is in the reader's head when they read that. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I do. Yeah, there's sort of a scrim of strangeness around it, you know.
Yeah.
A little
good.
Bit.
That's what I like.
And this strange cover is pretty strange, too, with the doll's
with the
face.
With the doll, yeah.
The sort of the wearing away of the nose and a little bit above the lips and the chin. And,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
It's kind of weird. But that's good.
Yeah, and I think it's one of those book covers that you, when you see it across the room, if you've seen the book before, you recognize it.
Hmm.
And that's really hard to do in this day and age, just to get a cover that looks like a one-off.
Did you see the cover before it went to print? Did you have any approval?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I do. And, you know, I always say to people, that's what agents do for you, is they negotiate a contract that has that kind of thing in it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're not represented by an agent, you can make sure that you do have, you can ask for it. They can say no, I guess, but there, you know, the language should be in your contract that they have to show it to you and give you input.
Hmm.
So that I always get a couple of covers as possibilities, and sometimes I don't like either one, and more often I will like one of them or suggest a tweak, which they'll do.
Hmm. We're out of time, and I wonder if, in closing, you have any sort of advice or tips for the novelists listening.
I guess my one piece of advice, and I always give this, is save everything. When you write and you don't like how it came out, save it. Put it away. Put it on the computer. When you upgrade your computer, move that stuff. Don't throw anything away, because what I have found is today's, you know, whatever the word for crap is really tomorrow's compost. You can use it, and then just hold your nose and write is my other piece of advice.
That's great. Oh, that's great. It's been a pleasure talking with you, Hallie. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Barbara, for having me on.
You're,
okay, great.
You're welcome.
Enjoy.
That was Hallie Efron. Her new book is You'll Never Know, Dear, and it's published by William Morrow. She has a website, HallieEfron.com. I wanted to ask her so much more, and maybe we'll have her on with the next book. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Lisa Brackman should be with us, so don't go anywhere.
Such a long, long time. Look like I get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just the thought of you turns my whole world misty blue. Just the mention of your name turns the flicker to a flame. Listen to me, good baby. I think of the things we used to do, and my whole world turns. misty blue. Heaven knows I've tried. You off of my mind, but I can't. Just the thought of you, my love, my whole world turns misty blue. Oh, 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 I can't, oh, I can't, oh, I can't forget you.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting from UC Irvine campus. We're on the web at kuci.org, and you can find podcasts, millions of them. Well, maybe not millions, but hundreds, maybe 1,000. I don't know how many at this point, but if you go to iTunes and subscribe to Writers on Writing, you will receive podcasts in your file when we upload a new one. This show should go up in another day or two or three. And you can also find archived shows at writersonwriting.blogspot.com. No excuse for not hearing the show. I'm going to bring on Lisa Brockman. She has worked as an executive at a major motion picture studio, an issues researcher in a presidential campaign, and was the singer-songwriter bassist in an L.A. rock band. Her debut novel, Rock Paper Tiger, set on the fringes of the Chinese art world, made several best-of lists, including Amazon's top 100 novels and top 10 mystery thrillers, and was also nominated for the Strand Magazine Critics Award for Best First Novel. Her second novel, Getaway, won the Los Angeles Book Festival Grand Prize and was nominated for the T. Jefferson Parker Skiba Award. Hour of the Rat, number 2 in the L.A. McEnroe series, was shortlisted for Left Coast's World Mystery Award, as was L.A. number 3, Dragon Day. Lisa lives in San Diego with a couple of cats and too many books and a bass ukulele, and she's here primarily to talk about her new novel, Black Swan Rising. Hi, Lisa.
Hello.
Hey. Let's begin by hearing about Black Swan Rising and how the book came about.
Well, Black Swan Rising was something that I first came up with in July of 2014, and I mentioned the date before I mentioned the subject. Black Swan Rising deals with misogyny, online harassment, and mass shootings in the context of a highly polarized political campaign. There are no Russians in it, however, which is how you can tell I thought of it in 2014. And it features three women. It's a multi-point of view novel, which is the first time that I've done something quite like that. Three female leads, one of whom is a young campaign worker with a secret that threatens her and threatens the campaign she's working on. The other is a local television news reporter who was injured in a mass shooting, and when she is assigned to do a feature story on the aftermath of shooting victims, she finds out a lot more about her the man who tried to kill her than she was expecting. And the third is the wife of the congressman who's running for election.
Okay.
And I'll just stop right there for now.
Well, you said it was, wasn't the easiest book to write, and I wonder what you meant by that.
I don't really think any book is easy to write, but some are more of a challenge than others. And, you know, they're challenging for different reasons. I mean, I've had books that were really hard to write because of where I was at in my life. I had books that were hard to write because I was stretching myself, and you know, which I generally try to do. I'm kind of into trying something different when I write a new book and not repeating the same kind of thing over and over again. And then you have books where it's a combination of those challenges plus the subject matter is uniquely upsetting. And I would say Black Swan Rising kind of hits on a few of those areas that made it tough. Although I wrote the first chapter and the pitch for the book in mid-2014, I started doing the writing in earnest at the end of 2015, and then the bulk of it was written in 2016. So while I was writing this book with all of these kind of hot-button topics, all of these hot-button things were going on around me as I was writing it, and it was just disturbing. You know, I mean, I had based the misogyny and the online harassment aspect of it off of Gamergate, which, if you're unfamiliar with, was something that happened in, you know, I think that started in 2013, maybe. But ostensibly, it was a campaign to promote ethical gamer journalism. But what it really turned into was harassment of women and people of color who had been talking about some of the sexist and racist tropes that you'll commonly find in video games. And they weren't even saying, guys, you can't have your big boob ladies in video games anymore. What they were mainly doing was pointing out that these kinds of tropes existed and also saying, you know, there's other people out there that would like to play games, and we're not really interested in this. We'd like to see some games that reflect our interests. And this turned into a vicious campaign of online harassment, and it bled over into the real world with death threats and doxing and swatting, which is when you call out a fake police threat or a, you know, a fake crime report at an address to see if you can get the SWAT team sent out there, which is extremely dangerous. Mm-hmm. I mean, people have died because of this. And but while I'm writing in 2016, I'm seeing how this same kind of strategy and tactics had made its way out into a bigger platform. If you look at the literature, the alt-right took a lot of its strategy and its tactics from Gamergate. It's an outgrowth of the same kind of people and the same kind of ways of accomplishing their results. And it was very disturbing. It was like, you know, oh, great, our national elections are dominated by trolls. And, you know, that was something I certainly didn't want to see, because I take politics kind of seriously.
Well, earlier you said that you know, you wrote this one, Multiple Point of View, and that you hadn't done that before. And I wondered if you found a certain freedom in doing that, or if it was restricting in other ways.
Oh, no, it was super fun. I mean, I've experimented with that in things that I've written and haven't tried to publish. Mm-hmm. And it's always enjoyable, because when you're writing, I mean, I tend to write either first person or a pretty close third person. And either way, with those points of view, you're restricted to what that point of view character knows. And that can be really fun, because, you know, you're putting the reader kind of directly into the position of this point of view character. The reader knows what the character knows, and there are many things you do not know, and that's what creates the suspense a lot of the time. So for this, I just needed to know and needed the reader to know more than a single point of view character was capable of accomplishing. So it was enjoyable, and you get a chance to play with different voices, and you know, Casey, the reporter, is a very different personality than Sarah, the campaign worker, and then Lindsay, the candidate's wife. So, you know, that's just really a fun thing to do as a writer, I think.
Hmm. Do you kind of scope out the characters beforehand? I mean, did you do any work on this one is going to be this type of character and this is the purpose of this one and this one's going to be this and this is the purpose of this one?
Oh, or that's just way more organization than I like, no, you know, there's an Ian Rankin quote that I tend to use a lot, which was, if I knew what was going to happen, why write the book?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, for me, the early pages are a process of discovery as to who these people are. And so I knew when I started, I had some ideas about Sarah and what kind of a personality she was and how kind of closed off she was and why. I knew what the broad strokes of the why for that. And, you know, I hadn't gotten very far into it. This isn't a spoiler to say that there's a mass shooting that happens very early in the book. The book takes place in San Diego, and that Sarah is watching this unfold from her couch, as we often do, you know, as we find ourselves for these breaking news events. And she's switching between the local news and her Twitter feed and comes across the Twitter feed and the reporting of Casey, who is covering the story, and we find out later that Casey was injured in the shooting. And I did that because I was like, you know, the thing about mass shootings is that there are these horrific tragedies, and we all grieve, but most of the time we're not directly affected by them. We don't know anybody to whom this happened, so we can kind of, you know, be horrified and appalled and feel the amount of empathy that we can feel, but it still isn't a personal connection. And I thought, well, you know, I want to at least give the reader some little connection that we've seen this character before, and now maybe I've killed her. And then I realized, as you know, not getting very much further than that, that for a whole aspect of the story that I wanted to tell, which was uncovering, you know, is there a conspiracy? Is there not? But you know, an investigative aspect, that Sarah, the campaign worker, really wasn't in the position to do a lot of that work. It wasn't logical for her to be doing it, you know, which is not to say we don't do a lot of mysteries where we see sleuths who logically would not really be involved. But, you know, I wanted to try to ground it a little bit more in something that was plausible. And I'm thinking, like, well, you know, Casey's in the perfect position to do that. She's an actual journalist. So, you know, and you know, through, you know, she pitches the story that since, you know, we do get outraged and upset and we grieve over a mass shooting and then the band plays on and there's a new one tomorrow, you know, that she pitches the idea of looking at the long-term ramifications for the community, for the victims. And it's a perfect in for her to find out more about the person who shot her and what his motivations were. So, and I can't remember why I came up with doing it from Lindsay's point of view. I think I wanted a little bit more insight into the candidate, into Matt, but I didn't want to tell it from his point of view. And I wanted to keep this, you know, there's so few kind of novels with political themes that focus on women, and mm-hmm. I guess I really wanted to keep it focused on women.
Mm-hmm. Well, you also said that you scared yourself while writing it, and I wondered if that's how you know when a book is working. Like, how do you know? How do you know when, you know, you're hitting a hard spot and it's you need to go in a different direction? How do you know when it's working? I mean, do you use readers to tell you that?
I tend to look at it like this, you know. I kind of keep my head down and focus on the sentence, and then I focus on the next sentence, and then I focus on the sentence after that, because eventually, you know, you got enough of those, you got a book. And so, you know, if the craft is working on a sentence level, it's generally going to work on a story level, is sort of how I look at it, and that may or may not be true, but that's what I tell myself. and I guess for me, how I know it's working, you know, there's always points along the way where you're going to kind of run into a wall, and try to figure out how am I getting over this wall, how am I getting through this wall, how am I getting around this wall. And those are kind of the signposts for me that it's like, okay, something's not working here. What is it? You know, what do I need to do? But with this book, the parts that scare me was that, you know, I'm writing a book that's set in San Diego, which is my hometown and where I recently returned a couple of years ago to live. And I do a lot of walking in the neighborhood. I do a lot of neighborhood exploration. And I didn't want to do it in, set it in kind of like a glamorous, you know, place in San Diego, like the beach or something that was, you know, kind of obvious. I wanted to do it in, I was basing it on an area where I lived, where the congressional district used to be a swing district. That was important. It needed to be a competitive race. So I'm out on my feet. I'm exploring this neighborhood. I'm trying to get the feel for it on the ground level. And, you know, and then I start shooting it up, you know. And I realized that, you know, getting involved in politics, and I'm a political person, and, you know, going to clubs and meeting my congressmen and meeting candidates who are running for office, all of this stuff is a lot more accessible than people tend to realize, I think, if they don't get involved. Mm-hmm. And that's really super important. It's super, super important. And, you know, part of what's wrong with our democracy is that people don't realize that these figures who they vote for or don't vote for or don't vote at all, but they're not these remote people for the most part. They're out there. You can meet them. You can talk to them. You can express your concerns. And that scared me because I realized how easy it would be for violence to become highly politicized, and that freaked me out. And I didn't really want to write about it, but I kind of had to. And, you know, just going through these environments like, okay, oh, here's a nice little community park. And, oh, look, you know, they have community fairs there. I think I need to have a community fair, and then something terrible happens. And I feel really bad about that. I mean, I had to fictionalize the park because I'm like, I don't want to shoot up my own park. Because it's all too real. These aren't like distant things, you know, that you can kind of sit back and enjoy because it's, you know, the supervillain genius of crime and a global plot to, you know, I don't know, set off chain nuclear. It's something that's really, really ground level and the kind of thing that you encounter every day. And given the situation in this country, far, far too easy for it to happen. So, you know, when we had that thing a couple of weeks ago where the guy was sending pipe bombs to all of these political figures, mm-hmm. I got a lot of calls. It's like, hey, that's like your book. I'm like, yeah.
Interesting. Oh, art reflecting life, or life reflecting art, or something about that.
Well, I mean, you know, when you look at the extent to which politics has degenerated into theater, the fact that there's a close relationship between the two, I think, becomes less surprising.
Mm-hmm. Sure does. Sadly. But on a happier note, I'm with Lisa Brockman, and her new book is Black Swan Rising. And you do setting particularly well, and I believe you also give workshops in setting, or at least you have. And will you talk about that? Because setting is such a vital part of a book, and having it kind of work in with the story instead of just plunked here and there, there can be an art to that.
Well, I have not yet given a class on setting. I'm going to in a couple of weeks at San Diego Writers, Inc. I think the one I did for them so far was suspense.
Okay.
Yeah. Setting is one of these things that, well, you know, it's more than the physical location. It's the time. It's the culture. It's the milieu that the characters are operating in. So there's a lot to it. And it's one of those things that, I think in part because I'm kind of I have a little bit of a background in screenwriting, not that I was ever successful with it, but I've done it. So there's a certain kind of writing that you do where you have to write enough to set the scene, but you don't spend a lot of time on interior characters' interior lives because, you know, that doesn't help the director figure out how to make the movie. You'd only give as much information as the director and the actors need to communicate the meaning of the story if it's not clear through the action. So I tend to have a default to, I'm pretty visually oriented. If I'm writing a scene, a lot of it is, you know, what the character is seeing and doing. And I think, you know, the key to that is, like you said, you have to work it in organically. And, you know, we had a discussion the other night on a panel for, you know, with a writer who was talking about that she was getting a lot of critique that she was doing info dumps in her 1978 setting, and that, you know, how do you explain phone booths to millennials? And we all kind of raised our hands and said, well, you don't. You have your character use the phone booth mm-hmm. the way she would use the phone booth and interpret the phone booth the way that she would interpret the phone booth, you know, unless you're doing Back to the Future, and then that's a whole other deal. But I think, you know, my primary principle with setting, and it's because I've done books set in China, for example, in contemporary China, and I did one set in Puerto Vallarta, and this one is, you know, San Diego. But with the China setting, a lot of people in the West, you know, you default to thinking that that's exotic because it's not familiar and it's, you know, it's very different than what you're used to. But to the, whatever it is, 1.4 billion Chinese people who wake up every morning, China is not exotic at all. It is normal. It's the default, right? And, you know, similarly, you know, here I am in San Diego. I was born and raised here. To me, I grew up thinking that San Diego was the normal, the default, right? I go to other parts of the world, even other parts of the country, although that's gotten a little less so, you know, now. And being from San Diego, being from Southern California, living in L.A., working in a film studio, this is all incredibly exotic stuff to people. So my principle with this kind of thing is you look for the ordinary in the, quote, exotic, and the exotic in the, quote, ordinary. Because once you really start examining setting closely, every place is unique. Mm-hmm. Every place is exotic in its own way. And every place is also ordinary in its own way.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good explanation. That's really good. But China, you mentioned China, and you ended up in China. But how? Why did you end up in China?
When you're 20 years old and you grow up in Southern California, and one of your best friend's parents are these people that are into, like, they were into, like, every 70s human potential movement up to and including nude swimming pool therapy. It was the 70s in California, right? And so they had gone on a teacher's tour of China in 1978. They were members of the U.S.-China People's Friendship Association, and this was before normal diplomatic relations had been established between the United States and the People's Republic, but it was on its way to happening. And while they were on this tour, they heard that the Chinese government was going to hire Americans to teach English for the first time since 1949. And they were like, well, that sounds interesting. Let's apply for that, you know, and they got these jobs. And so, you know, I was going to college. I was a sophomore in college. And my friend Paul says to me, hey, you know, you want to go with me and visit my parents in China? And I was like, yeah, sure, that sounds like fun. So that was how it was. You know, I can't say that it was exactly random because, you know, we had to go to a lot of trouble to get my visa, and, you know, it took some effort, but there still was an element of, like, you know, if they'd been, you know, in Botswana, do you want to go visit my parents in Botswana? Sure, that sounds like fun. I would have gone, you know, just about anywhere. So, yeah. And I got a lot more than I bargained for out of that trip, for sure. It was supposed to be a couple of weeks, and it ended up being 6 months, and I taught a quarter of conversational English to Chinese college students who were older than I was because they'd been out in the countryside during the Cultural Revolution, and, you know, the universities had just reopened less than a year ago, you know. So it was all a pretty big deal.
Yeah, that's interesting. I love that picture of you. Maybe it's on your website or somewhere of you in China. I think that's...
The one when I'm with my class?
Yeah.
And I got my little hat on, and
it
says "Be Read and Expert" on the wall. Yeah. There's another classroom that had the sign, a foreign language is a weapon in the struggle of life. So it was a pretty interesting point of view to be exposed to, for sure.
Also, you know, I wanted to ask you about going from writing screenplays to novels, and I wondered if you went straight to novels, or did you go the short story route first?
I was one of these people that, you know, I couldn't maintain a major, but I did briefly have a writing major that turned into a writing minor. And I had thought at the time that I wanted to write screenplays, and I was working on a screenplay that I worked on for years because, you know, when you're 21, that happens. But I did take classes for a writing major briefly, and one of my first professors, one of my only professors, was Lydia Davis. And I don't know if you...
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah. So, you know, she's a MacArthur Genius Grant winner and is known for her short fiction primarily and for her translation of French. But she was very, very, very concerned with precision in language and focus and you know, measuring your words. And that had a real impact on me and how I approached writing. So in the back of my mind, even though I wanted to write screenplays, you know, I'd done, you know, some short fiction, obviously, in college, and I'd already sort of developed some ideas about prose. And I wrote a bunch of, you know, teleplays for fun and things for fun and realized it's like, okay, I got to get serious. You know, I was in L.A. working at a film studio, and I should be trying to write a feature film because that's the easiest way for someone who doesn't have credits to get some. And I'll just think of some big idea, and I'll get paid all this money, and it'll be awesome. But I couldn't think of it. You know, I couldn't think of that big idea. So for fun, I decided I would write prose, and I'd write a novel. And I just kind of called it my trashy novel. And I had all these rules about, you know, you will write this number of words a night, and once you get to the end of the chapter, you can't go back. Because I was mainly just trying to work on my chops. And keep writing while I was thinking of this six-figure screenplay idea that mm-hmm. never materialized.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized as I wrote that I really liked writing prose, and I liked writing novels. And I haven't written that many short stories. I've written two since college. So I kind of went right from screenplays into novel writing. I liked the fact that, you know, you had time to say what you wanted to say and to introduce complexity and I don't know, the longer narrative form was just kind of more comfortable to me. Although when I was trying to write screenplay stuff, I was much more comfortable with hour-long TV. For some reason, that felt like, okay, I like doing this. I don't really like writing feature screenplays that much. So, yeah, I've written a short story that was in San Diego Noir, part of the Akashic series.
Sure. Uh-huh.
And I wrote a short story that's coming out next year. It is a Go-Go's-themed anthology to support Planned Parenthood that's edited by Holly West. And I think it's Down and Out Books that's bringing it out.
Mm-hmm.
And those were really fun to do. I really enjoyed them. But I think, you know, novels are always where my mind goes first.
Mm. And we're at the end of our time. This has gone incredibly fast. I wonder if...
I talk a lot.
No, and it's all interesting. And I wonder if in closing you have any sort of advice or pearls of wisdom for the writers, the novelists listening.
You know, I probably don't have any better advice than anybody else does, which is, you know, read good books and write as much as you can. I do agree, my cat's entertaining me here, with the idea that you should think of writing as a job and don't wait for the muse to come down and bless you with pearls of wisdom or what have you. You know, park your butt in a chair, try to set a schedule, try to write a little bit, and you'll be surprised at how quickly things will pile up if you develop a discipline. And I say this as a person who likes to sleep late and go out and hang out with friends, but
well,
that's what I got.
Well, I appreciate you getting up for us. And,
yes, I did.
You sound quite awake. So thank you so much for spending time.
Well, thanks for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Of course. It was Lisa Brockman. Her new novel is Black Swan Rising, and that's all we have today. If you want to listen to this show, if you tune in a little bit later, you want to hear it again, visit iTunes. Look up Writers on Writing. It'll be podcasts in the next couple of days. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. You've been listening to Writers on Writing. Thank you for being here.